French.
Hey, I'm Rob McDonald.
And this is the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast.
We're going to talk about everything from fishing and hunting to hiking, paddling, and adventures on the Great Plains. And we'll cover it all here.
So join us each episode and hear what's going on in the great outdoors on the Great Plains. Hey folks, welcome to another episode of the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast. We are wrapping up turkey season here across the Great Plains, and it's been a lot of fun connecting with folks about their season. I know there's been a lot of great memories being made out there in the turkey woods. Rob, I know you guys had a good turkey season.
Yeah, hey Brittany. We had a pretty solid season for sure. So far, our family of three turkey hunters, myself and my two sons, we've been able to fill two of our three tags. So I'm still planning to get out there with my youngest son. Definitely late season turkey hunting right now. We're going to try and fill his tag. And hopefully we can get that done. And there's a good chance that our turkey season will actually be closed out before this episode airs. So, you know, through the magic of recording, hopefully we'll be talking about a successful turkey hunt here soon. And talking about those kids turkey hunting, I've been following along with Outdoor Mentors and the many, many turkey hunts that your organization has facilitated with. I'm sure you have some numbers of how many youth hunters got out, including my oldest son, Mason, did an Outdoor Mentors hunt. So hats off to you and your team for a great turkey season.
Oh, well, thanks for that, Rob. It's been really cool to watch our team work. And I mean, all credit to the good Lord upstairs for providing for us and opening the hearts of all of our landowners and our mentors, because that's how it all works, is all of us coming together. But between Iowa and Kansas, I think we're looking at over 100 hunts. So that's been a record year for us. And not all of them led to harvest, but all of them led to a lot of great life lessons. And that's always the most important part, and in my opinion anyway. But with that being said, you know, this episode that we're going to be talking about here today is really important, because as you can imagine, turkey season is kind of a hot topic right now. We've heard lots of conversations about decrease in turkey numbers. I've, you know, witnessed a lot of this on the ground that we've been hunting. And it's not just here in Kansas or in Iowa, it's across North America, across the Great Plains. In fact, Kansas just changed their turkey regulations in response to the loss of turkeys across the states. And I'm sure there are many other states looking at doing the same things. So with all this turkey talk, it seems fitting to introduce our guest today as we wrap up the turkey season. Our guests here today are Ron and Tess Jolly with Turkeys for Tomorrow. Ron has hunted turkeys for 6 decades. He is an award-winning author, video, and television producer, and a member of the National Wild Turkey Federation's Grand National Hall of Fame. No small feat there, Ron.
Thank you.
Tess Jolly is the co-owner of Jolly's Outdoor Visions with a 25-year career as a freelance outdoor photographer and writer whose specialties are wild turkey and whitetail deer photography. If you haven't looked at some of her work, I strongly encourage you doing that, because it's just beautiful. Tess is also an award-winning, her award-winning work appears in the national and regional conservation-based publication, books, calendars, and online. Tess worked as a professional turkey guide at the Alabama's White Oak Plantation and served as an archery instructor at Alabama's Becoming an Outdoor Woman workshop that introduces women to a variety of outdoor-related activities, including hunting and fishing. With more than 5 decades of hunting experience, Tess takes an active role in mentoring and passing on hunting and conservation skills to women and youth in the outdoors. Her work helps promote Turkeys for Tomorrow's mission in assisting with science-based solutions to improve the plight of wild turkey. And we just appreciate you both so much for being here with us today to talk about this. I know I've been anticipating you both coming on here, so welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Appreciate it. It's an honor to be here with you all. It's from my home state, so it's especially nice to be with you.
Yes, Tess, you're a Kansas girl, is that right?
Yeah, born in Wichita, lived near Morganville, got a lot of family, still in Kansas.
I love that. Hawkers. I love that.
Jayhawkers forever.
Good stuff. Well, I'm curious, Ron and Tess, You know, I know Brittany gave us a good introduction, but if you don't mind, just tell us a little bit more about yourself, what our listeners might want to glean from your expertise as, before we get started into Turkeys for Tomorrow and what that is and how it got started.
Well, my experience, my career started in the late 1980s with a company called Primo's. I was a producer and public relations director there for almost 10 years, and I had a hand in some of the early Primo's turkey, deer, and elk videos, waterfowl videos. And long about the end of my career, I met this young lady, and I figured out it was going to be a lot more fun traveling with her than it was with Primo's. So we've been doing that for almost 30 years now.
Pushing there. Not quite, but almost.
That's good stuff.
You did well there, Ron.
I married up.
You did. You sure did.
I don't know if you're ready to get into Turkeys for Tomorrow, but first and foremost, if you ask Tess and me, first thing we'll tell you is we're passionate about wild turkeys. We work with them. We hunt them. We love to eat them. But we also want to make sure that they're still here when our grandkids and their grandkids. And there was in our minds, it was very obvious, especially here on our farm, something really went wrong about 8 years ago here. I won't get into what we think it is. We'll probably get into that inadvertently. But so when I was inducted into the Hall of Fame, a bunch of those old Primo's guys came because we hadn't seen each other, some of them in 20, 25 years. And we went out to dinner and we were talking about, well, what about the turkeys where you hunt? Or what about where you hunt? And we all had made the same observations. So we decided to get together at White Oak, Tess's old stomping grounds, in June of that year. And there were 14 people there. And we had that roundtable discussion, and I took the questions that were asked and wrote and published a story for Gamekeepers Magazine. And the title of that story was, If Not You, Who? And the who is going to fix it. So we left there with kind of, you know, warm and fuzzy feeling of getting together after all those years. But it just kept bugging us. So we got together again via phone, and we decided, well, let's just see if we can do something. So 13 people or 14 people pledged $300 a piece. And that's where it started. And now we got our 501c3 to be 27 months ago, the 20th of this month. And it's come far. And that's just a testament to the passion that turkey hunters have about the bird and the willingness that they have to support anything that they think is going to help them recuperate and be around forever.
That's a pretty amazing story, sort of a pull yourself up by your bootstrap sort of a saga. You know, I can appreciate that, you know, if not us, then who, like who are we going to ask to do it? So you got to appreciate that grit to be like, well, what do they say when you point your finger? There's three more pointing back at you. So, yeah, I appreciate that, Ron.
Well, it's been quite a journey, and this is not something that Tess and I got up one morning and decided that this is something that we wanted to do. The Lord laid this on my heart really hard because I'd had a very long and storied career of being around and chasing turkeys and sharing that with people through television and videos and stuff. So I feel very responsible and I feel very obligated to try to give something back. And that's what TFT is about.
I love that. It's so selfish or selfless, sorry, of you guys to have that perspective too. It's not what else can I get from this experience, right? And turkey hunting, it's like, now how can I give back? So I know that it's going to be around for future generations.
Both of us had parents that said you need to leave the world better than what you found it. and follow family traditions of conservation and passing on respect for wildlife, respect for the outdoors, and finding solutions. And that's what TFT does, is it raises money to help find science-based solutions. And they're going to be different depending on the area, but to really focus on finding solutions and involving the hunting community. And they are, like Ron said, people are just begging to help out.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that it's going toward actual solutions for their areas.
I love that. Let's talk more about that, because I feel like right off the bat, you can tell that's a huge difference between your NGO organization and others. How are you guys kind of structured, and how does that look different from other NGOs?
Well, I don't know that we're that much different than anybody else out there. If we are, we don't point it out. We focus on our mission, and our mission is anything that will help wild turkeys, period. We don't, you know, we love deer and hummingbirds, bluebirds, and all those other things, ducks and quail. But our philosophy is, if we can help turkeys, we can help them all. So our focus is on our mission and to move that needle a little at a time. This is a huge, huge undertaking. Each of these projects are 4 or 5 year projects. So we're just barely over 2 years old. So we don't have a lot to, you know, to show you what we've done, but
except funding them.
Except funding them.
Yeah, you're funding them, waiting for the data.
So at the founding meeting, when we decided, it was 1 year later at White Oak, we decided to move this thing forward. And I mean, we'd already applied for our 501c3 and we're struggling for money and all those things. But we set some real hard goals. That I'm a goal-oriented person. If you've ever been in video or television production, you know you have to set goals and meet them, just like you with your podcast. You have to have so many of them to keep the doors open. So our first set of goals was 5 research projects in 5 states in 5 years. And that was a very, very lofty goal when you start with $3,600 or $3,900.
That's a pretty lean budget.
Yeah. So here we are, almost 27 months old, and we have 8 research projects in 6 states. Another goal we set at the 1st of March of 22 was by the 1st of March in 23 to have 1,000 members. Well, here it is, 15 months, and we just topped 2,500 members. We set goal to launch a minimum of 10 chapters across the country this year. We've done 5 and held those events, and we're probably going to get close to 15 before this year's up. And that in itself is a huge undertaking. It's just so many moving parts. And
so, I'd say too that I'm sorry.
Well, I want to stop you before we get too far ahead on exactly what Turkeys for Tomorrow is doing. And I want to back up to kind of where you started with setting these goals. And, you know, I can recognize what you're talking about as far as the same thing that your group recognized when you guys gathered. Like, I live on a cow-calf ranch in the Flint Hills of Kansas, and the creek on our place for, you know, years and years and years, in the springtime, there would be a flock of turkeys that would have 5 or 6 toms in it. It'd probably have 7 or 8, maybe 10 jakes in it. And the hens that would go along with that group, right? They'd move in and out, and there'd be groups coming from, but you didn't have to go very far away, maybe a mile or two, and you'd see that same thing again on another creek, right? There just were birds. Now, the last probably 3 or 4 seasons, if we see 2 toms together, that's kind of abnormal, you know? And so when you're sitting there in the woods and you call one in and that's the only tom that you've seen on that stretch of creek bottom for all spring, we got to think pretty hard about whether or not we want to harvest that bird. And so I think we all can recognize the issue, but the root of the problem, it sounds like that's what you're trying to find. So what does that look like? You're funding research projects in multiple states. I guess maybe an example of one or two of those research projects, like, do you partner with a university or a wildlife and parks department, or, is it biologists that work for Turkeys for Tomorrow? Pheasants Forever kind of has that model where they employ biologists by Pheasants Forever. Or, how are you guys trying to accomplish these projects and what do they look like?
Well, the projects we're doing right now are pretty diverse. This all started in Alabama, and we finally scraped up enough money to do one project, and we went to Auburn University, and Dr. Will Goolsbee says, with the money you got, we can probably do what's called, we call it the Song Meter Project, where they put out ARUs, or autonomous recording units, and those units record, I think, 4 hours from a certain time in the morning to on up to like 10 o'clock in the morning. And they can analyze the gobbling across the landscape. And we partnered with the Hunting Public and the University of Georgia. And the Hunting Public and UGA did the same thing on public land in Alabama. We did it on private. But when we went to the DCNR here, they told us what they thought needed to be done. And we were fortunate enough to find a partner in Alabama Wildlife Federation that said, well, let's just do it all. Well, there's only one problem with that, Mr. Tim Gothard. We don't have that money. He said, are you going to get it? I said, yes, sir, I'm going to get it. He said, how long is it going to take? I said, can you give me 60 days? He shook my hand. Yes, sir. And I sweated bullets for 40 days and gave him his money. And that was the launch of it. Now we're doing feral hog impact. We're doing disease study, reproductive study, and nesting success in Alabama. In Kentucky with UGA and Dr. Chamberlain, we're just extended the footprint of that to get it in a different set of hills. In Tennessee with Dr. Craig Harper and University of Tennessee, they were concluding a 5-year study. And during the last two seasons that study was underway, he convinced the conservation department, the TWRA in that state, to postpone the season to 2 weeks later in those five counties. Well, they did it 2 years. And then they changed it for the whole state this year. Well, Dr. Harper didn't think he had enough data for a long enough period, and the funding was out, so he asked us, will we extend it? Yes, sir. But what he would tell you readily, that they did learn out of those 5 years, that to their findings, mammalian predators are the biggest problem with recruitment, with poult recruitment.
In Tennessee.
But it's really hard to get people just to biologists and these universities, they have to have things in stone. I mean, there can be no maybes or ifs. When they know in stone, they'll say. But, we're not there with anybody yet.
Well, and but one good thing about with Turkeys for Tomorrow, these colleges like Dr. Chamberlain and University of Georgia and Dr. Goolsbee and Auburn are sharing data, and they've shared those ARUs. There's some collaboration going, not only with the hunting public, turkey hunters through TFT, but with these colleges, and people they're giving them data in the layman's terms, so they can see what's being studied. It's a big step forward. The communication is much better too.
We had Dr. Chamberlain on our podcast earlier this season. I appreciated talking to him so much as you guys probably do too, is he described researching turkeys as a game of football. Yeah. And if you want to get caught up in the weeds, you focus on that one thing, right? But if you zoom out, there's a lot of time left in that football game, and there's a lot of variables that you have to research and look at.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we'll link that the show with Dr. Chamberlain in the show notes. But what I'm hearing from you, Ron, is that you're partnering with primarily with universities, and you're able to either start a project or continue to fund an ongoing project, or maybe bolt on another piece to an existing project that they didn't have going. And that you're looking at factors sort of all across the board in those different projects, from disease to predators to habitat. So it sounds like you're trying to really cover the gamut.
Well, we are, but none of us are the founders or the board or the directors of Turkeys Tomorrow. We do have one biologist who's our treasurer, but none of us are scientists except for Mark Yarborough. And Mark serves as our treasurer, and he manages a big WMA for the state of Mississippi. But our job, we realized early on, is to listen to these researchers and these people who are educated, are trained to find these problems. And when they convince us that they're on a right tangent, our job is to fund it. That's our only job, is to find the funds, but let them do their job. So that's what we try to do. We're getting to the place now to where, you know, how many different ways do you need to prove this one thing? So we're looking for something totally out of the box right now that could be an answer that nobody's really looked at. And that news will be coming hopefully by the end of July. One of the steps we took was thinking we were doing, I'll actually give you two examples. In Iowa, they're in the middle of a 10-year study. I think they're going into their third year. And they wanted to put another layer on that study, and it's DNA sampling of predated hens. They've got almost 100 hens with GPS markers on them. So they know where they are. They know where they go. They know when they stop going and assume they're dead. And they can go recover that. And they can also pretty much tell once they start incubating a nest, and once they abandon that, then they can go in and do a DNA swab on the inside, on those busted eggshells, and on that predated hen, and they can identify the type predator that did it. So heck yeah, we put the money in there for that. That's kind of out of the box. The state of Mississippi, to track these hens and or these other turkeys and kind of figure out their preferences on habitat at certain times of year, we have to go trap these birds with cannon nets, put GPS markers on them. Dr. Aaron Marin and Dr. Mark McConnell at Mississippi State have, I don't think they invented this, but they realized that a technique that was being used for red grouse in Europe could possibly work on turkeys. And we call it the Poop Project. What they do, they go in and the students mark out the territories and all this, and they pick up turkey poop and feathers. And there's enough DNA on that feather to identify that bird.
And start a database.
Yeah. And there's enough information in that poop. They can check it for aflatoxins. They can check it for LPDV, for disease. They can get a good idea of what the diet was. And they never touched that bird. Mm-hmm. So those are the things that TFT is really looking for. There's one out there somewhere. I just don't know. I think I know one that we're really going to do. And we have an in-person board meeting in early June, and we'll make that decision. And then when we do, if we do it, everybody else will know too. But, you know, there's been years and years and years of turkey research done. So, you know, we don't want to keep doing the same stuff. You get the same answers, and it's not fixing it. We got to find something different.
Well, there are other side reasons. You know, even with COVID for 2 years, people had free time, and there was a lot more hunting pressure in a lot, especially down here in the Southeast. There were more birds killed. That even can be taken into account over a 2-year period, that You know, depends on your hunting pressure and people's hunting ethics, whether they're willing to, like you said, Rob, just hunt, but don't pull the trigger. If you know for a fact that your numbers are down, there, the hunter is involved in this too. So with social media, Turkeys for Tomorrow just took off like a wildfire. Once word got out that they were really looking for ways to fund solutions for the decrease in turkeys, a lot of people are stepping forward, and it's really good to see.
Yeah, so you covered a lot of topics there, Ron, and we're going to definitely gonna have to have you and Tess, both of you did. We'll have to have you both back as some of these research projects wrap up. You know, if you're in year two of five or year three of 10 or whatever that is, like, it's going to be very interesting to see what the end of those projects. You know, you hear all sorts of things. I know Delta has done a tremendous amount of studying of waterfowl habitat and meso predator reduction at nesting time, and they've been able to quantify success rates, nesting success rates going from 1% in a control environment, clear up to like 80% success in an environment where they're trapping meso predators during the nesting time. And you hear all sorts of things about, you know, floods and droughts and how those affected nesting, and herbicides and pesticides and how those might be affecting birds. So I'm excited that the work you guys are doing is so diverse and spread across different regions. I'm curious, do you have any projects that you're a part of in any of the Great Plains or in Kansas, Nebraska, the Dakotas doing anything?
The one in Iowa, I don't know if that's considered the Great Plains, but there will be a project of some sort that comes out of the one shot there in Kansas. I talked to those people the other day, and that's a startup deal, and they're going to have some money, and they're already talking to Kent Fricky, the turkey biologist there, on how they're going to start it in I think it's Butler County where we were. It'll be on a small basis to start with, but the proceeds of that are going back to what they were intended to do. And we'll grow that. It'll be a lot bigger next year, a lot more successful.
More chapters.
There'll be more chapters around the country. And as we're trying to expand that, our membership base grows. And then that just helps us with people to put on the ground. I mean, we don't have personnel. That's one of our big problems right now is personnel to be. I need to be in Georgia this weekend. I'm supposed to be in Georgia this weekend. Our granddaughter's coming next weekend, but then it's Missouri, Arkansas, Florida. You know, I'm too old for all that, you know.
We thought we were retired.
That's what you get for thinking that.
Yes. Yeah. But they're doing some summer events rather than just your standard banquet, mm-hmm. To auction and all. They're doing a shooting sporting clay
several of those
event and some golf tournaments.
Very good.
They're attracting different demographics that way.
Mm-hmm. How does that work for you guys? You talked about chapters, right? What states are you guys in? Where are some of your chapters, I guess? And, you know, what's that look like if somebody is interested in, you know, after they hear this podcast, man, I really want to get involved in that.
Okay. We've done five. Three were in Alabama, mm-hmm. one in Georgia, and one in Iowa this year. They've netted right around $130,000. So they've been very successful. Our goal was to do a minimum of 10 this fiscal year, but a maximum of 15 because the personnel we have to do it. And we're trying to make sure that they're quality. We're not doing quantity. There's not going to be a TFT chapter in every town down the road. They're going to be regional. They're going to be areas where people that are serious enough that they can take it on and support it and start putting some of that funding back on the ground in their area. You can go to turkeysfortomorrow.org, and there's a a drop-down box where you can fill out a form. If you're interested in creating a chapter in your area, you fill out that form, and within 3 days, someone will call you and discuss it. That list of names right now is north of 90 people. Now, are
a lot of interest.
Are all those legit? I hope so. I hope so.
Yeah. But
if they are, we don't have the personnel to do that right now.
You know, I think you all are in like a very sweet spot, though. When you say that, you know, no personnel, they're probably running you and the other founding folks a little ragged, right? You know, managing what you guys have going on, that's a lot. But that also allows you guys to be really specific to how you grow this organization, which I really like, because you're doing that with a lot of intention, right? You're saying you want to establish regional chapters because you want these folks to be incredibly committed and excited about pouring money into research and to better the future of turkeys.
It's more than just research. We're going to do, for instance, we have two habitat days this year. One's in Missouri with Dr. Grant Wood. That's the second weekend in June, I'm pretty sure. You can go to the website and see that. And then there'll be one in Virginia with Ward Burton Foundation in August. And they're limited to 100 people or so. But that's 100 landowners who can go back and make a difference on their dirt.
And pass on what they learned there. You know, it's...
And we started in Alabama through the Cooperative Extension Service. One of the biggest questions asked to these agents is, what's happened to my turkeys? So we've done three in Alabama, and we can duplicate that in every county in this state. So
I want to back up on that, Ron. You mentioned something interesting to me. So I'm familiar with Dr. Grant Woods and his proving grounds over there in Branson. Is that right?
North of Branson.
Yeah. So you're doing research projects, but then you're also doing some education projects. Is that what I'm hearing? So that if you're a landowner or can game agencies, is this something that they could attend? Or, you know, I don't know what that looks like as far as you're bringing folks where there's experts that are doing some of this work on purpose for turkeys. To go to a regional area, see what that looks like, and then go home and implement some of that practice?
Yes, Dr. Woods will have several other experts there doing different things, habitat, planning, fire, results of fire, all that. You get there on one day and you spend the whole Saturday in the field with Dr. Woods and that staff of people. Then you go back, and I'm pretty sure the closing banquet will be at the Bass Pro Shops headquarters, their theater there. It's $500 a person. That covers everything except getting there. And it's limited to 100 because that's all he can handle. This is another one of those tests that we're doing to see, is this feasible? Are the people going to be interested enough in it to come and learn and take it home with them? I know they are on a local level in Alabama because we've had close to 200 people at the three we've done. So, you know, Dr. Goolsby or one of the other land-based universities will send an expert there to lead those things across the state. So, It's a grassroots effort, and we're trying different things in different ways, but we know this, that first you got to find the answers, but there's also a common sense side that we can do without having to wait 5 years for the end of a project.
Sure.
And one of them is trapping. Mm-hmm. So we've partnered with the National Trappers Association, and we're fixing to put out a list of trappers for hire. That you can contact them and find a person that will come trap your land for you, or they will come set up a seminar if you'll help organize it and teach your people and your neighbors how to trap. Also, those guys are very, very, you know, you would think that as a bunch of trappers, they're about trapping, but they're not. They're about conservation, and they're about what a trapper can do, or what what's kind of gotten out of balance in the natural world since a raccoon hide is worth $3 now. Yeah,
fur prices are.
Right. Yeah. So I'm a trapper from a long time ago. And, you know, my kids, so we still talk about the fur shed. I've got my fur shed out here that's got all my traps hanging in there and my flushing beam and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, to your point, when there is no market, it makes it hard to pay for gas. Right. And then what do you do with the furs after you're taking them? But to hear you talk about that, where you're trying to connect landowners with trappers, it's pretty foreign to me as an old trapper, because I remember the days when other trappers were competing for places to go.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's kind of backwards where, you know, when the market, and I didn't trap in the big boom, you know, of the 70s and 80s when there was $30 and $40 raccoons. That was kind of before my trapping time. Yeah. And so those days, you know, trappers were covering each other up, and you didn't see like a roadkill raccoon wouldn't last very long because somebody stopped to pick it up. You know, that was like $30 or $40 in 1980 currency, you know, laying on the road. But now we're in this spot where, yeah, to your point, everything is out of balance when it comes to prey and predator on the landscape. And no doubt that's part of the problem.
And it's not just turkeys that they affect. There's all kinds of bird species that, you know, from your waterfowl to your other, you know, ground nesting birds and right. All.
Well, somebody asked me, said, what are you trying to do? Wipe out the raccoon population? I said, sir, we couldn't do it when they were $30 a head. I doubt we're going to do it when they're three.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of truth to that statement.
Plus the way everybody feeds deer now, that's probably an issue. I know it makes a nest predator's life a whole lot easier. Mm-hmm. They become more productive, and their population just blows up, you know? So,
and it's like Grand Central Station for whatever comes to that feed area, and a turkey hen will come to that feed area. And in my opinion, that just helps your nest predators find those nests. There's a lot of sign that's left at a feeding area and where animals come and go, and they're easier to cross paths with going to a feeder. And you know that coyotes and bobcats and all of your bigger predators that actually kill the bird, then the nest predators come along and they finish off the nest. So you've got a big problem there. Mm-hmm.
Well, plus with chronic wasting disease, mm-hmm. and all these other things, aflatoxins, disease spread, it just doesn't make sense to me to be, you know, piling these critters up like that. But yeah. Mm-hmm. Another thing I want to mention, since we're kind of talking about educating people, we were approached by Dr. Goolsby from Auburn and Dr. Lashley from the University of Florida. They had an idea to start a podcast that would go back and do all the reviews of all this research on the ground and take on some of these tough issues that just weren't being talked about. The baiting, the fanning, mm-hmm. all this stuff. So they call it the Wild Turkey Science Podcast, and they asked us for $40,000. That's what the asking price to edit it, to fund it, to fully fund it. Well, we thought it was worth it, but what are the deliverables on that? Their goal was at the end of the year to have 100,000 downloads. Well, I just talked to Dr. Lashley today, and this thing launched in the middle of January, and it's right at 150,000 downloads right now.
Nice. So,
wow.
6 months.
Yeah. It's just gone bonkers. So, you know, my idea was, yeah, we'll put up 40 and we'll sell 20 of it off to share it. But I don't think we're going to do it now. I think we just have to hold on to that one.
Mm-hmm. That's excellent. And what a great platform. I'm looking at it right now. There's 9 episodes and you're saying there's over 150,000 downloads. That's pretty special. What I love about that the most is that you guys are streamlining probably some of the best turkey research that's ever been conducted out there. And you're eliminating the, I heard this on Facebook and my buddy old pal told me this, right? Like, this is hard science. It's kind of hard to argue with that.
Absolutely. Dr. Chamberlain also is one of the experts in the South. He has the Wild Turkey Lab. And he has a website also that people can go to see all of his social media posts, Turkey Tuesdays. There's a lot of good information that people can find through podcasts and going to these social media sites of these biologists and these colleges to get science-based information as well.
If you ask me right now what I think the most important thing TFT's accomplished, I think you'd be surprised, but I'm going to tell you anyway, if you don't mind. When we started this, it was hard to get people in charge to discuss this with you. It was, you'd always get the same answers. It's a natural reproductive cycle. They're up and down. Or it's a natural cycle. Ah, you're exaggerating. And we just kept kicking on that door until finally we hit the right spot and we got somebody else talking about it. And I think you know yourself right now that the decline of the wild turkey is probably one of the hottest topics in the outdoor industry right now.
Yeah.
So if we didn't do anything but that makes me feel very good.
Just right. You just stirred up the pot enough to get the stuff that was stuck to the bottom to rise to the top where everybody can see it.
A lot of awareness on it right now.
Well, yeah. I'd like to tell you that was always fun and easy, but it wasn't.
Well, what do you guys think about lightning round? You ready for a few questions?
She's good at
it. This is a test.
Yeah, no. You won't be graded, I don't think. Are you going to grade them, Brittany?
No, I think I'll let these two slide.
Okay. Go.
Do you want me to start it off, Rob?
Sure. So, right. Brittany, you're going to do the questions for Tess, and then I'll do the questions for Ron. Is that's the game plan?
I like it.
Okay.
How long are the answers?
Yeah. Yes or no, true or false?
As long as you want them to be. We have some folks who really have to defend their reasoning for a lot of things. It's kind of fun.
Okay.
Well, for reference, I met Tess and Ron at this thing we talked about, the Kansas one-shot turkey hunt. So for those of you who aren't familiar with it, it was the Kansas governor's one-shot turkey hunt for many years. They kind of reestablished it this past year and had a great turnout. But that's where I got to meet Tess, because she was mentoring one of our very delightful youth hunters, Caitlin, during the event. And it was just so much fun to hear from Tess about that experience, but also be squeezed by Caitlin half to death because she was just so excited and so thankful for the opportunity. So this question is kind of framed around that, because right away, Tess, I know your passion is through mentorship, and I could pick that up within 2 minutes of talking to you. Would you rather mentor either a young person, a kiddo, or even adult in a turkey blind with a camera in your hand or with a shotgun in your hand?
Oh, always a camera.
Yeah. Okay.
I'd rather have a camera in my hand, because you have that opportunity to shoot, you know, the action and the story and the whole experience. I've shot my share of turkeys and other wildlife throughout my life, and just being able to record it is way better, more satisfying, and more long-lived.
Yeah, that cliche, a picture's worth a thousand words. Absolutely. It really is. It really is. Well, I encourage folks to go check out your work, because I was going through some of your Instagram today, and some of those pictures are breathtaking. You just see such a different light of conservation in the outdoors through your work.
Well, I appreciate it.
My
mantra is, you must be present to win. When people say, how did you get that shot? You spend, you know, I love being around turkeys. Mm-hmm. That's my thing. I never get tired of being around turkeys. You always learn something new.
Yeah.
And photography is just like hunting. You scout it the same, and a lot of the setup is the same. But you get to recycle the birds. Mm-hmm. And that's what I like.
That's neat. I like that. I like that a lot. I know in the past we had our good friend Joe Dickey on, and he's a well-known videographer, photographer, and we kind of all geeked out about camera setups and video setups and all that good stuff. So for our listeners, what would be your go-to camera setup for outdoor wildlife photography?
Depends on the size of the animal that you're really wanting to focus on. But generally, for turkeys, you need a little more lens. I use a 120 to 300 and 2.8 and also a 400, which is reaches out there. And then the digital cameras today, you can get in full frame or what they call a crop frame. Mm-hmm. The DX, the crop frame, actually crops down what you see, so it's like you've magnified it. So a 400 lens becomes a 600. You know, you get that field of view. So for turkeys, I'm a Nikon shooter, have been from the start, and I shoot a Nikon D5 and a D500. And the 120 to 300 is a great all-around lens for deer, turkeys, anything. And then throw in a wider one for portraits after the hunt.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing. But you can't beat a good cell phone camera either. Everybody should keep that cell phone charged up when they're on the hunt, because the technology in iPhones or what we use, I shot stuff with Caitlin, shot video clips and all, and you know, just being able to tell that story is very important to me.
And yeah, I like that. I like those recommendations.
Good tripod too, if you're going to shoot wildlife. Now, I don't use it all the time. If I'm moving and walking, trying to, you know, slip on up on animals, but anytime you're in a blind, you need good support for the rig.
Mm-hmm. I do like that, especially if you're capturing anything with kids. Tripods are great.
Yeah.
I agree with that. Well, Tess, I know a little bit about your background, and just being an avid outdoors woman you are, I'm just curious what your preference is on this one. When you're out hunting, are you more of an archery hunter, or are you more of a firearm hunter, or are you a little bit of both, depending on what season is and how it goes about?
Well, at my age, and I will tell you, I've been hunting for 61 years. Mm-hmm. So that gives you an idea of my age.
29, I started, right?
Yeah, something like that. I'm going in reverse now. I'm going backwards on my birthdays. But seriously, when I was younger, it was all archery, you know, for deer and fishing, bow fishing and all. But as I aged into life, you know, I did a combination of both. Mm-hmm. The latest bow equipment that either of us used was crossbows.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pretty much into rifles and shotguns, pistols now. Just when you get older, sometimes you can't draw because of old injuries and things like that. So we all learn to adjust just so that we can still be out there. So
yeah, make it.
Crossbow is great. I've crossbow hunted for turkeys as well. But
yeah, I think that's always important. I feel like we're all a little too proud sometimes to admit when we have to pivot and change things. But I think that's part of being an outdoor enthusiast, is, you know, you have to accept, like, I bummed my shoulder out and I can't do that anymore. Or, you know, this season I'm not going to be able to pull that bow back, so I'll try my shotgun. And it's
good.
Great all around. I love it. Yeah.
My dad hunted until 3 months before he died, and he was 93. He shot a bow 3 months before he passed. He never quit, but he had to adjust as he got older and all. I mean, he took oxygen to the blind with him.
Oh, my gosh.
There the last year, and still had the biggest smile as he did when he was young, when he'd shoot a deer. And Mom was the same way. So I think we can all learn a lesson from our parents that have, you know, given us that example, is don't give up on the outdoors as you get older. You know, just find ways to be out there. And luckily, we've been able to hold up pretty good so far. So I'm not planning on quitting.
That's a good word. I like that a lot. Tess, I can't remember the podcast that I listened to recently that you were on, but you talked about, you know, you mentioned 61 years of hunting, right? Experience. Mm-hmm. What was it kind of like being that trailblazer as a woman representing the outdoors? I mean, that one was probably different for you being that limited female representation in the room, but I mean, what did that just in a snapshot, how did that work for you? What did that look like for you when you were getting started?
Well, I got started when Dad smuggled me into the men only hunt club because they didn't let girls in on any days except Thanksgiving and Christmas. And that was in the 1960s. And that was just the culture then. Men hunted mm-hmm. and women didn't necessarily hunt. But in the Midwest, in Kansas, women did hunt. Mm-hmm. My mom hunted on her honeymoon. So when we moved to Florida, he found out the hunt club he joined didn't allow girls and women. So he was a law-abiding man, but he told me, if you want to hunt hard bad enough, you're going to hunt. So I started out early hunting and being the only girl. So, you know, he broke ground for me there. My dad did. And I never had any, I was undercover for about 3 years, except for the immediate group we hunted with. But as I got older, you know, there were a few girls that hunted, but what really started it was a Becoming an Outdoors Woman program. When it launched in 1995, I was asked to volunteer my archery, to teach basic archery. And I was just flabbergasted at how many women out there had never had anybody just say, do you want to go hunting? Do you want to go with me? And that was the best 25 years I spent was meeting women and helping them get introduced to the outdoors, not just in archery, but in other ways. Mm-hmm. And personally, I've heard other women say that they've met with some resistance over the years, but I guess I'm just been blessed. I have just not met the resistance mm-hmm. To it. And I think a lot of it is women don't need to go into it as a competition against their spouse or their boyfriend or whatever, you know, a serious competition. I think we're all there to have a good time. And it's really good to see little girls and young women have mm-hmm. those opportunities through the NRA, through NWTF's programs, through the Becoming an Outdoors Woman program, all introducing them. So I've been involved with mentoring for a long time through that and with disabled people too. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the thing that's closest to my heart is mm-hmm. getting to see somebody's eyes light up when they're outdoors.
Yeah,
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you for paving the way for so many kids and, you know, anybody who's just curious enough for learning in the outdoors. I mean, it's pretty special.
Well, Caitlin was a great example. She already has parents that expose her to the outdoors, but just getting to hunt together mm-hmm. It created a bond. And, you know, she'll be a lifelong friend as well as her family, but that's what the outdoors does to you when you really love it, is it creates bonds and it helps young people and like Caitlin and any other young person to grow in their self-esteem, mm-hmm. to overcome fears, to learn more about the natural world and their responsibility to it. As they mm-hmm. get to be adults, they have responsibilities to take care of what's entrusted to them. And it's just so much more of a big picture than just going hunting and shooting a turkey or shooting a deer. And I like that.
Yeah. I love that too. I love that for all the kids and people you've empowered with too over the years and will continue to empower. Because like you said, you're not slowing down anytime soon.
I'm not planning to. They have to dig me out of my blind. But the Pass It On Outdoor Mentors is just, my first experience with them was back in West Virginia, probably 12 years ago, and met Mike. Mm-hmm. And I knew then it was a great organization. And I've kept up through emails and newsletters through the years. And this opportunity was really special. they just, you all do just wonderful work. Your social media posts are so uplifting. Mm-hmm. And I just want to commend all of you all on that team for the dedication and the love, because it takes love to do mm-hmm. it. And that's what we're supposed to do in this world.
Yes. Well, I appreciate that. And I'll be sure to pass it on to everybody.
Yeah.
Great
work. Great work.
Yeah. Thank you, Tess. I appreciate that. You did good. I feel like I should have asked you some harder questions. Well, maybe Rob's going to fill that void when he talks.
You could ask me what my dad called me. My name is Harvey.
Well, now, what was it?
Harvey. I dressed as a boy. They put a poppy hat on me and dressed me like real baggy old army fatigues from the surplus store. And he told me, don't smile at anybody with those dimples and stay in the truck unless I tell you to get out.
And that's true that you cut your hair as well?
I had a little pixie cut. It was from the time I was 9 until I was 11. And then then I started smiling at some of the boys that were riding by with their dad in their hunting vehicle. And the cat was out of the bag. And the next year, they rescinded that rule. They had a meeting at the Salt Springs Hunt Club on Lake George in Florida, and decided, well, if some of these daughters want to hunt and women, I guess maybe we should take them. So my dad, he's in heaven right now, but I credit him with really breaking a barrier down way, way back. Mm-hmm. And there were 3 other daughters besides me that were hunting with their dads the next year.
Wow.
I got to come out of the Harvey thing, but Harvey stuck. Everybody that knows me from my childhood calls me Harvey.
Oh, that's comical. I love that. It's a good story.
Well, Ron, I don't know if we can follow up on that very well, but I've got 4 questions for you that they won't be too hard.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so number one, lifelong turkey hunter. Obviously, you're passionate about hunting turkeys. I'm curious, what's your favorite turkey call? You're going to the woods, and you can only take one call with you. What's your favorite turkey call?
Mouth diaphragm call.
Mouth diaphragm call. Okay. Number 2, with all of the advances in shot technology, bismuth and tungsten and all the stuff going on in that arena, you know, you got guys that are trying to knock down turkeys at long distances with like a 410, that kind of stuff happening. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just curious, what's your favorite turkey shell? What do you like to hunt with?
I like to shoot number 9 TSS, but I don't shoot it past 40 yards.
Okay.
And here's one.
Is that a 20 gauge or a 12 or a 28 or a 16?
It's a 20 gauge.
20 gauge. Okay.
It's a 20 gauge. But to me, turkey hunting is a game of how close, not how far.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
Sometime I'll connect with you. And I'll send you a video. My son, my oldest boy, last year, it was his first year to call in a bird by himself, mm-hmm. and he called in. He wound up killing a Jake, which I was totally fine with. And he called this Jake into about 6 paces.
Oh wow!
Yeah, and the whole time it was spitting and drumming, and there was 4 of them, and the other birds were gobbling. You know that little Jake cackle gobble, and they were trying to put on a show and. One of them, finally, he couldn't take it anymore, and he comes strutting right in there, and I thought, oh, he's going to miss. That bird's way too close, and he didn't. He finished the job, and, you know, no blind or anything. We're just sitting right at the base of a tree, and it was a heck of a hunt, so I'll have to share that with you sometime.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So question number 3, you mentioned that you do like to eat turkeys, which I think we all appreciate. It's one of my favorite wild game species for the kitchen. What's your favorite recipe? If you got to kill one turkey this year and you were like, man, this is the dish that I have to have when I've got wild turkey in the cooler or the refrigerator or the freezer or whatever, what's that dish?
Fried.
Breaded and fried?
Soaked in buttermilk for 8 hours, breaded and fried.
Just with seasoned flour, or is there a special? Yeah. I know some guys use... blended up cheesy crackers or chips
we've got a little blend that we use on about everything. I can't say it to the name of it.
What, you want me to?
Yeah.
Saturan?
No, oh. Special.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. We've got a special blend herb thing, but it's a tongue in cheek kind of.
Okay.
Family oriented.
All right. Tess, did I hear you say you like to have turkey smoked?
Yes, sir. We've got a smoker, and I like to cure meats and make bacon and all of that. And smoked turkey is one of my favorite. I brine it and then overnight, and then wrap it in bacon and smoke it in usually pecan and apple, something a light wood, and then slice it for sandwiches. It's
nice.
Super good.
Yes, yeah, please.
Now I'm getting good. Hungry.
Is it dinner time?
Never, ever throw away the hindquarters.
That's right.
I made wild turkey enchiladas. They're just, you just got to cook them low and slow for about 8 hours, and then use that meat for, that's great in any of your Mexican dishes.
Yeah.
And a lot of people waste a good part of the turkey.
Right. Just turkey tacos at our house.
Oh yeah.
Do what?
Turkey leg tacos at our house.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I just ate them yesterday.
We're big on the insides too, the heart and the liver. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I got one more question, number four, and then I'm going to give you a bonus question because I'm curious as much as you guys are around turkey hunting. So number four, we've been sticking with the favorites, favorite call, favorite shell, favorite recipe. Where's your favorite place to hunt turkeys? You've been hunting all across the country in your career. And if you were to think back on a special place, where would be your favorite place that you've had an opportunity to hunt turkeys?
I would have to say probably New York State.
Really? That's cool.
Okay.
New York State is absolutely beautiful. I hadn't been there in several years, but there was just a ton of turkeys. You could only hunt in the mornings, and you'd go trout fishing in the afternoon. You know, just always something to do, and beautiful scenery and lots of birds. Now, my confidence state, if I need some confidence, is Texas.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. So here's the bonus question, and I hadn't thought about that till just right now, but you guys are lifelong turkey hunters and passionate about it. And, you know, everybody, you get a fan mounted, you get a beautiful fan or whatever, and you save the beard and folks save the spurs, and, you know, there's nostalgia and photography of the hunt and of the trophy and the birds and all of that. A few years ago, I got, and you've probably heard of this, I got turned on to a guy that will cut open the crop and save anything that's not organic in there. So little rocks and pebbles and things like that, and then put it in a jar and kind of collect. Is that something that you guys do?
No, but I just saw that and I'm going to start doing it. I'm late in life doing it, but if you're young, you should start it. That is
pretty interesting.
The greatest idea.
Fascinating.
I just saw that.
Good stuff.
Can I volunteer something right here, Rob?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
One of mine and Tess's mentors in our writing careers was a gentleman named Jim Cassidy. He's from North Carolina. And I used to keep a diary and field journal because I needed that to keep up with my production and my writings and stuff. But Jim told me one day, he says, we'd called a turkey up and he shot it. And he picked that hull up. And Tess and I have a tradition when we shoot a bird, we'll snip off a sapling and put that tombstone right there. Just leave it.
The shell.
Just the empty casing. And, you know, we go back by him and we recognize that. Well, Mr. Cassidy, for every turkey he shot, he goes home and he writes a little note on where that was shot and when and the date and who he's with. And he tucks it in that hole and puts it in a big dish. That's cool.
Like that. Great tradition.
That's pretty cool. Okay.
That's really, really neat.
That's something that a lot of people wouldn't think about, but it takes 5 minutes to do. And then grandkids can go. I mean, you just put it out there and people can pull it out and read it. It's a great legacy. Another way to honor the bird.
I like that a lot.
My mom made feather flowers out of turkey feathers. all the body feathers, I would save them for her. And we'd go the sunflowers that grow wild, like in Kansas, let them dry out, let the seeds fall out, and then fill that head with glue, with Elmer's glue. And she would trim those feathers and make these gorgeous wild turkey feather flowers.
Wow. Oh, cool. I love that. Yeah. Love that.
Great way to utilize and have a memory. So the vase had flowers, you know, from different hunts.
I love that. Hey, before we wrap up here, did y'all get married on an elk hunt? Did I see that properly?
We married ourselves. We got married first before we left, but we did our own vows. And
I wondered. Yeah. I love that. I just happened to come across, I think it was you guys were celebrating one of your anniversaries on one of your posts there. And I saw you said, I married this guy and I harvested an elk.
Yeah, that was our honeymoon.
It was so sweet. I love that. But it just shows, you know, a snippet into your guys' lives in the outdoors and how much you guys value that and your companionship in the outdoors, too. So I just think that's great.
Well, we appreciate it. It's what brought us together and it's what's keeping us together.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ron, Tess, how can people connect with you? What's the Turkeys for Tomorrow website? And do y'all have social media? If so, what channels are you on?
Okay. You can follow us on social media at Turkeys for Tomorrow on Instagram. And it's Turkey and same on Facebook, Turkeys for Tomorrow. And then on the website is turkeysfortomorrow.org.
Perfect. Perfect. And we'll be sure to link those as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, no, thank you guys both for joining us. I know I had a lot of fun chatting with you guys more and just hearing more about the mission of Turkeys for Tomorrow. Thank you for what you're doing and what you'll continue to do.
Well, thank you.
We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on. And it's great to meet you know, virtually. And hopefully we can connect maybe next year at the One Shop.
There we go.
That would be awesome. That would be awesome. Can I give you my Instagram?
Yes. Absolutely. Please do.
Instagram is @JOVTest. It's just like Jolly's Outdoor Vision acronym, @JOVTest. And then Facebook is Tess Randall Jolly, 1S.
Yes. And get excited because you're going to find some great photos on her Instagram.
Appreciate it.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys. Yeah. Thank you. And we'll see you guys out there.
Absolutely. Right. Thank you.
Tell your sidekicks, I think Mr. Gunnar Sullivan, hello for us.
I sure will.
It's great.
All right. We'll see you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.